We always recommend Shopify. It took us from an idea to a real business. We got set up, I think, in less than a day. With very little effort, we could just focus on the supply chains and the product development. Shopify gives us the ability to customize without the complexity. We can change something without introducing fragility or having to pay a developer. We're Thirsty Turtle, and we leveled up our business with Shopify.
Start your free trial at shopify.com/au.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
I found out my father had died through a terse legal email from a firm I didn't recognize. No condolences, just the subject line that read, "Notice of deceased estate transfer, urgent response required." Attached were two PDFs, one listing my name as contact details and next of kin, and another outlining the property I was set to inherit. A single address in rural Kentucky, a parcel of land just shy of 60 acres, and a two-story house that had been last appraised in the early 2000s. Beneath that was a line I reread three times before I fully registered. Workshop, restricted access, outbuilding number 1, contents presumed hazardous, consult County Code 43B. I hadn't spoken to my father in nearly 20 years. We hadn't fought exactly, just drifted, gradually and inevitably, until the silence between us became the only thing either of us seemed willing to maintain. Even when my mother died, he hadn't called. The funeral passed without a word from him, and I'd learned long ago not to expect anything more. He had his work, and whatever that work became over time, it had consumed him. The drive into the hills brought it all back. That thick, dark stretch of Kentucky forest, the way the road narrowed the further you got from anything with a proper zip code. The GPS cut out an hour before I reached the property line. By then, the trees had thickened into walls on either side of the gravel road, and the shadows between them were so dense, it looked more like dusk than early afternoon. I slowed the car almost unconsciously, listening to the crunch of tires on stone, aware that I hadn't seen another vehicle for miles. The house stood at the edge of a clearing, tucked into the tree line, as if it knew not to intrude too far. It looked the way I remembered it, tall and tired, with flaking white paint and a porch that sagged in the middle. Ivy had begun its slow, deliberate crawl at one side, wrapping the windows with curling vines. A faded, private property sign hung crookedly from a nail by the door, the lettering half obscured by dirt and weather stains. Inside, the air smelled of dust. The furniture was all intact, though covered in white sheets, the way old houses tend to be in movies, and not so often in real life. His taxidermy tools were still hanging in the hallway, lined up with almost surgical precision. Bone saws, fine wire, curved needles, all clean, all in their place. The fireplace was filled with ash that looked recent, and a mug still sat by the chair in the study, ringed with the brown residue of long evaporated coffee. I didn't go into the workshop right away. After the warning in the letter, I was apprehensive of what I'd find. Still, I walked out to the building, stared at the door, tested the handle, and found it locked. A heavy chain had been run through the bolted latch, the keyhole rusted but not broken. A single weathered tag hung from the handle, tied in place with red thread. Written in a steady hand, The words were simple. Keep it shut. It didn't surprise me. My father had always treated that space as sacred. When I was 13, he let me watch him mount a fox, hand steady, voice quiet, like a priest in a shrine. I remember the way he stitched the skin back together, humming low under his breath. When I asked why he spent so much time making dead things look alive again, he said without looking up, "Preserving something is the only way to save it from the mountain." At the time, I thought it was a metaphor, a poeticism from a man who saw art in dead things. But there was no mistaking the gravity in his voice when he said it, nor the way he stared at the wall afterward, as if he were listening for something behind it. The town was a 20-minute drive along winding roads, tucked low between the hills. A gas station, a grocery store, a diner. Not much else. When I walked into the grocery store, the woman in the counter looked up, did a double take, and then went completely still. Her expression smoothed out into politeness, but it wasn't the kind born of courtesy. It felt practiced, hesitant. "You're Elijah's boy," she said after a moment, though I hadn't given her a name. I nodded, unsure of the tone in her voice. She gave a faint smile, glanced toward the rear of the store, then quickly added, "Let me know if you need anything." As I walked the aisles, I caught another customer pausing near the produce, eyes tracking me without subtlety. I noticed the man outside the window cross himself once before quickly turning away. It was a quiet reaction, almost instinctive, but it lingered in my head the rest of the day. I didn't think much of it. I assumed it was the kind of tight-knit community awkwardness small towns specialized in. Outsiders were always observed, sometimes resented. I'd forgotten how strange it felt to be somewhere everyone remembered your last name. But it wasn't hostility I felt in those glances. It was something else. Something closer to wariness, or maybe reverence. And behind it all, I could sense a strange question in how they watched me and didn't speak of my father at all. The house creaked with age every time I stepped across the warped floorboards. Though it had been built to last, it hadn't been lived in properly for years, and the weight of silence pressed against the walls harder than any storm ever could. There were signs that my father had lived here until the very end. An old kettle still resting on the stove, slippers placed neatly beside his worn recliner. But there was no warmth left in the rooms. Just residue. The mounts were the first thing that started to unsettle me. He had always surrounded himself with his work, and the living room was no exception. Heads stared out from the walls. A red fox with matted fur, a hawk frozen in mid-screech, a dozen squirrels with arched backs and glassy, frozen tension in their limbs. A bobcat posed on the mantel, one paw extended, mouth drawn back in a snarl. But the expression didn't read as predatory. It looked surprised, almost embarrassed. Each of the eyes had the same strange quality I remembered from when I was young. Too reflective and focused, as if the gaze followed even when you turned your back. Some of the animals weren't posed for realism at all. A possum on the corner shelf was sitting upright in a child's chair, dressed in a doll's clothing, paws folded in its lap. A raccoon on the bookshelf had spectacles resting on its snout, and a tiny copy of Walden glued into its paws. My father had often done this kind of thing, treated his taxidermy as preservation and storytelling. He used to joke that animals deserved to be remembered not for how they died, but for who they could have been. I hadn't laughed the last time he said it. I wasn't sure if it was meant to be comforting or a warning. I didn't find the key until that evening, when I was thumbing through the shelves in his study. Most of the books were what you'd expect. Anatomy manuals, wildlife field guides, a few volumes on mortuary science. But which, between two copies of a leather-bound family Bible, was a much older edition, heavy and dry with age. I instinctively opened it and found a hollow carved out in the middle. Nestled inside was a single iron key wrapped in cloth. On the opposite page, the entire section of Leviticus had been torn out, not cut, not carefully removed, ripped by hand, as if in anger or urgency. Outside, the grass was knee-high, wild and overgrown, thick with seed heads. Beyond the rusting garden gate stood the workshop. It was taller than I remembered, with a pitched roof and windowless walls wrapped in thick ivy. Every nail, every board seemed carefully placed. It had the look of something that had been built slowly, with enormous patience and no intention of ever being abandoned. The lock on the door was old brass, darkened from years of weather. I'd already found the chain earlier, looped tight and secured with a keyed padlock. My father had always guarded his workspace, but now it felt more like a warning than a barrier. I didn't wait until morning. The key fit the padlock perfectly, and the chain fell away. The door opened easier than the others that fell to disrepair, revealing a darkness that smelled of cedarwood, dust, and the faintest trace of chemical sweetness. I reached for the light and found the pull cord, which snapped down with a metallic click. Fluorescent lights buzzed to life overhead, flickering once before settling. The space was much larger than I remembered. The walls were lined with shelves of labeled jars and plastic storage tubs. At the far end stood an industrial-grade workbench with a leather stool beside it, tools arranged above with obsessive precision. There were bones on the shelves, tiny skulls, preserved eyes, threads, needles, bottles of tanning solution, wires and foam molds. His entire world was kept in perfect order. But what caught my attention was the covered form. It was shrouded in beige drop cloths, still and absent, but I could see the suggestion of limbs beneath the fabric. Arms folded across chest, legs slightly bent, the outlines of heads that seemed too round, too soft. I pulled the cover off. Beneath it was a figure, human-shaped, about the size of an adolescent child, though thinner, with elongated limbs and a narrowed waist. The skin was stitched tight over the form, pale and patchworked, with subtle shifts in colour and texture that told me it had not come from one source. The hands were too small, the feet are too broad. But what freaked me out was what it looked to be made of. Animal parts were cobbled together to make the amalgamation of shapes. The torso was seamless, but the shoulders looked animal, slightly hunched, ridged beneath the surface. The face was calm, serene even, eyes open, mouth parted just enough to suggest breath. It was an abomination, a sick imitation of human life. The eyes were glass, of course. They weren't the mass-produced kind you ordered from a taxidermy supplier. They looked custom, too real. I couldn't explain it beyond a gut reaction. I'd seen hundreds of mounted animals in my life, and I even helped preserve a few. But this was something else. I stared at it longer than I meant to, trying to make sense of the proportions, the materials, the reason. It had to be some artistic experiment, a commission maybe, something for a gallery or a private collector with odd tastes. My father had always flirted with art as much as science. Still, I dropped the cloth back over the figure before leaving the workshop. And when I turned off the light, I could have sworn it had shifted slightly in the dark. I found her at the bar on the edge of town, the one with a rusted jukebox and a pool table that hadn't seen a straight queue in 20 years. It was early afternoon, and the place was empty except for a few old men nursing long-warmed beer and the woman behind the counter. She looked up when I walked in, eyes narrowing briefly before recognition softened her expression. "You're Elijah's boy," she said, wiping a hand on a towel. "Didn't think you'd ever show." "I wasn't planning to," I replied, "but here I am." She gestured to a stool and poured me something amber without asking. I took it. Her name was Ruth. I remembered her now, in pieces. She'd been older than me when we were kids, maybe 8 or 9 years older, and had worked in this bar even back then. She still wore her dark hair tied up, and there was a silver ring on her nose that looked recent. Her eyes held a mixture of curiosity and caution. We talked about nothing for a while. Weather, power outages, and a storm that had rolled through the valley a week before. She asked about the house, and I told her it was just as I remembered. We didn't talk about my father, not at first. It hung between us, though, thick and obvious. Eventually, after a second cigarette and my third drink, I'd asked the question I'd been holding in since I arrived. What was my father really doing up there? She exhaled slowly, eyes flicking to the window. A wind pushed the curtain of dust across the empty parking lot. She didn't answer at first. She just pulled out another cigarette and lit it with a match that she struck against the bar's metal edge. "You ever hear about the missing children?" she asked. I shook my head. "They don't talk about it anymore, not officially, but people remember." She looked past me now, her voice steady but low. "It used to be every couple of months a kid would vanish. No struggle, no noise, just gone. Folks blame the woods, wild animals, running away. But they never found bodies, not one. Just toys left in the fields, shoes by the riverbanks." I listened, feeling the chill settle into my spine. "Town almost up and left. But then your great-grandfather showed up," she continued. "Stranger back then, didn't belong here. But he built the house and set up a shop, started doing odd jobs for the town, kept to himself mostly. Then, around the time he finished that workshop of his, the disappearances stopped." "What does that have to do with me?" I asked, though the answer was starting to form. "Your family's never really been part of us, not in the normal way. But when things got quiet, people let it be. No more missing kids, no more mothers waking up to empty cribs. And the ones who remembered just told their children and their children's children to stay away from the ridge." I frowned. "The ridge?" Ruth stubbed out a cigarette and finally looked at me. "You never went up there as a kid, did you?" "No," I said slowly. "My father wouldn't let me." That much was true. I remembered the day I'd asked about it. I was 10. It had been the end of summer, the air sticky and still, and I'd wandered too far past the tree line behind the house. When I got back, My father had been waiting. Not even angry in the usual way, but the way his face had looked. White, hollow, terrified. That stuck with me more than any punishment ever could. He grabbed my arm, pulled me into the workshop, and told me to never go beyond the ridge again. Not alone, not at dusk. His voice had cracked when he said it. "You can smell grief," he whispered, like it was a fact of nature. "That's what it waits for." At the time, I thought he was talking about a bear, or maybe something more metaphorical. A lesson in coping with loss, or how sadness leaves you vulnerable. But now, I wasn't so sure. Ruth poured another drink and leaned on the bar. "Your grandfather took over after your great-grandfather died, then your father after him. That house isn't just a house. That workshop isn't just a studio. They were preservers. That's what they were called, though not out loud. You were either born into it or you weren't, and your family always was." "Preservers of what?" I asked. She didn't answer at first, just shook her head. "Whatever's out there," she finally said. "Whatever your family was holding at bay." I laughed, but it came out thin and strained. "You really believe that?" "I don't need to believe it," she said. "I just remember what happened the one time there wasn't a preserver. Your father left for a year after your mother passed. Do you remember that?" I shook my head, but asked her to continue. "There were two kids taken in that gap, and when your father returned, reopened the workshop and started working again, they stopped." I didn't know what to say to that, didn't know how to process it. It sounded absurd. But then again, so did the figure in the workshop, the child, the seams, the glass eyes. "People won't say it out loud," she continued, "but they're watching you because you're Elijah's son." I drained the rest of my drink and sat in silence, the taste lingering on my tongue like ash. By the third day, I'd started making a checklist. There were utility companies to call, property records to transfer, and a dozen minor errands I hadn't anticipated. The sooner everything was handled, the sooner I could get the house listed and gone. That was the plan. No need to stay longer than necessary. I returned to the town with a folder of documents tucked under one arm and a list of questions in my phone, hoping for a few straightforward conversations. What I found instead was more of that quiet, sidelong energy I couldn't quite pin down. It was in the way people greeted me with soft smiles that didn't reach their eyes, or the way conversations seemed to pause when I stepped too close. At the county clerk's office, I asked about transferring the property. The woman behind the desk was pleasant, but vague. "There's a few steps," she said, flipping through the binder that looked older than she was. "You'll need to file locally. Probably have to wait on county sign-off." "How long does that usually take?" She blinked. "Depends." "On what?" She offered another smile and glanced toward the hallway behind her. "Lots of things, but we'll do our best to help. Don't you worry." It wasn't refusal, yet it didn't feel like a straight answer either. The whole conversation felt padded with something too soft to push through. At the utility office, I tried to disconnect the water and electricity. The man behind the glass told me the system was in a backlog. When I pressed for details, he shrugged and said I might be better off waiting a bit before I filed. The grocery store was no better. The same woman from earlier still remembered my name and still asked about the house again. There was a cautious distance behind her tone. She offered me a discount at the register I hadn't asked for. The man behind me muttered something I didn't catch, and she gave him a quick glare. No one spoke after that. I drove back to the house with the windows down, trying to shake off the feeling. Maybe it was just rural bureaucracy. Maybe small towns really were this awkward around outsiders, and I had forgotten what it was like to be watched for nothing more than showing up. Still, the sense of being surrounded by people who were waiting for something I hadn't agreed to kept crawling back in. I didn't know what they expected. I wasn't staying. I had a job, a life, a home far from here. All I wanted was to get things in order and move on. As I sat on the porch, nursing a warm beer that evening, a man pulled into the drive. He stepped out of an old pickup, moved slowly and deliberately, with the kind of confidence that comes from being part of a place for too long to question it. He introduced himself as Vernon Mott, said he was part of the local historical society, though the way he said it gave the impression that his title was more about tradition than any real bureaucracy. His shirt was clean, tucked into faded jeans, and he wore a black belt with a silver buckle that had been worn smooth from decades of use. He had the kind of face that looked older than it probably was, all deep lines and windburn. We talked politely for a few minutes. He asked how I was settling in, whether I needed anything. I told him I appreciated the help, but what I really needed was information. Namely, how to speed up the paperwork, how to get the utilities handled, why everyone seemed to stall when I mentioned selling the place. His mouth twitched. Not a smile, not quite. More of a sigh escaped his lips. "I can't speak for everyone," he said. "They mean well. It's just not easy." "Not easy to what?" I asked. "Let go of the house, deal with outsiders?" He looked down at his boots, then back up at me. "They're not afraid of you," he said. "They're afraid you won't stay." I didn't answer, not right away. His words hit with more weight than I expected. This wasn't suspicion. This was something closer to resignation. A town bracing for something they feared might happen again. "I'm not planning to stay," I admitted. "I never was." "I figured," he said. "You've got that look, same one your father had when he left the first time." I stared at him. "I'm not judging," he added, "but I know what happens when the house goes empty. I've seen it." He paused, then glanced toward the tree line beyond the yard. His tone changed. "I won't ask you to believe anything. Not yet. But I'll ask you this. Come meet me at the ridge, past the tree line, just after sunset." "For what?" I asked. He didn't answer right away, just stepped back toward his truck. "To understand," he said finally. "Nothing more." Then he left. No goodbye, no pressure, just the sound of his tires grinding down the gravel road until they disappeared into the dark.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
The sun had already begun to dip when I found Vernon waiting just beyond the split rail fence at the edge of the property. As I approached, he gave a silent, shallow nod and turned toward the woods. I followed without a word, the only sound between us the crunch of dried leaves underfoot and the rasp of wind filtering through the canopy. The trees thickened quickly, pressing in from both sides. Paths weren't marked out here. Whatever trail we followed was made through memory alone, worn by years of footfall rather than signs or blazes. Brambles reached toward us, snagging at our sleeves. A low fog coiled near the roots, carrying the damp scent of moss and iron. After 15 minutes of walking in silence, Vernon raised one hand to hold me. His voice was quiet but heavy. "From here on, you must not speak. Don't even breathe too loudly. If it hears us, it may not understand." I nodded once, not trusting myself to ask what he meant. We moved slower after that, picking our way through the thickets of ferns and roots slick with decay. The light dimmed rapidly, the woods grew still. No birds, no insects, just the sound of my own breath and the occasional crack of twigs underfoot. Eventually, the forest opened into a clearing. It was not shaped naturally. The trees along the edges had bowed inward, their branches reaching toward each other overhead like the ribs of a collapsed lung. At the center of the clearing sat something I had no words for. At first, I thought it was part of the forest. A massive shape hunched low, covered in layers of bark and moss. But then it shifted, and I saw the seams. The movement was slow, almost graceful, and entirely wrong. It was enormous, crouched in the clearing like a thing too large for the world around it. Its body was a patchwork of flesh and hide, stitched together by time and instinct. Some parts moved with the weight of muscle beneath skin, while others creaked like dry branches being bent too far. Its shape was loosely human in structure, but warped by growth and time, and some fundamental misunderstanding of form. Its shoulders were broad, sloping downward into arms that ended in elongated hands, each finger tipped with a different claw or hoof. Tufts of hair sprouted along its back. A jaw protruded from beneath one shoulder, mismatched and slack. But it was the way it held the thing in its arms that froze me in place. It was cradling something, a figure roughly the size of a child, though lumpy and slumped in strange ways, as if its limbs had softened or rotted inward. The skin was pale and patchy, its arms wrapped tight around its midsection. I could see stitches unraveling across its neck, the head lolling at an angle that suggested it might not be fully attached anymore. The creature stroked the figure gently, its oversized fingers adjusting an arm, tucking a loose flap of skin back into place. It rocked the child slowly, rhythmically, with the soft urgency of something that did not understand time, but felt it slipping away. I could not move, could not look away. The thing it held reminded me too much of what I'd found in the workshop. The same glassy stillness, the same too long limbs and sagging expression. But this one was older, broken down, handled too much. It looked like it had been played with for far too long. Vernon leaned in close, barely breathing, and whispered into the edge of my ear. "We call it the parent. It sits here and plays with its child. And it's almost done with that one." I turned my head slightly, eyes still locked on the clearing. "What happens when it finishes?" I mouthed. He didn't answer, but I saw his throat tighten, his jaw shift. The kind of look people give when they're thinking of graves. Then the parent paused, his fingers stopped moving. The head turned just a little, and though its face was a tangle of parts I couldn't quite interpret, I knew it was listening. One massive arm lifted, held there midair, suspended with uncanny stillness. Vernon did not move, neither did I. Something passed between the trees behind us, a breeze or a shadow, I could not say. But the parent shifted again, returning its attention to the thing in its arms. It resumed its motion, rocking once more. Vernon tapped my wrist and began to back away, one step at a time. I mirrored him, keeping my eyes low, careful not to snap a single twig. It took us nearly 20 minutes to reach the edge of the woods again. Only once we were back in the open air of the field did he speak. "It doesn't find children anymore," he said. His voice was rough, almost hoarse. "Not when it has one, not when the illusion holds." I didn't say anything. "But when the body breaks down, when the seams go soft or the smell fades, it starts to wonder. And it doesn't know what it's looking for, only that something is missing." We stood in silence, the stars beginning to emerge overhead. I eventually found my words. Why don't you leave? Just get out of here, away from that thing," I asked. Vernon looked at me bluntly. "You think we can just pick up our houses, carry them to the next valley over? Yours is probably the first new car people have seen in years. And besides that, the parent hasn't been an issue for decades, not since your great-grandfather moved here," he answered. "But that will change soon. The things your father made were built to last," he said. "Humans don't. Once it starts, it won't stop." I looked back toward the woods, the trees still and dark. "And you think that thing I found in the workshop?" "It was the last one your father made. He must have known it was wearing down. That's why he was working on another." I nodded, though I felt nothing in that moment but the slow, rising pulse of dread. "It's waiting," Vernon said, "and if it finishes with that one before another is ready, it will start to search again, same as it always had." He left me standing in the field, saying nothing more. I watched him go, then looked back at the tree line once more, wondering how much time we had left. I lay in bed that night, staring at the ceiling long after the darkness had settled over the house. The blankets were pulled tight around me, but there was no warmth. My mind circled endlessly around what I had seen in the clearing. The way the creature had cradled that broken thing in its arms, the tenderness of its movements, the way its massive body had tensed when it heard us. The parent. That was what Vernon had called it, though the word didn't feel sufficient. Parents are human. They protect, they nurture, they know when to let go. This thing did none of those things. It only held on. I turned onto my side and tried to breathe deeply, but every breath caught in my throat. My father had lived with that knowledge. He had known what was out there and chose to stay. He made those things with his own hands again and again to keep the creature from wandering. He built them as decoys or offerings or something stranger. I still didn't understand. And now it had been months, maybe longer, since the last one had begun to unravel. It would come again. That much was clear. But not for me. I wasn't my father. I hadn't asked for this, and I hadn't agreed to carry it. I had come here to settle in this state, not inherit a burden that pressed against the edge of reason. There was still time. I could sell the property, leave the workshop locked, and be gone before it ever came too close. I told myself this again and again, until it stopped sounding like cowardice. The next morning, I drove back into town and made a show of visiting the grocery store and post office. I stopped by the county clerk's office with a fake smile and asked about the remaining paperwork. I spoke carefully, hinting that I was still thinking things over and might not leave right away after all. The clerk, an older woman with tired eyes, nodded along with me. But when I asked about the property transfer again, she sighed and flipped through a ledger with exaggerated patience. "Still waiting on a couple signatures," she said. "You know how it is. Takes time." I nodded, pretending not to see the way she avoided meeting my gaze. It was a stall tactic, the same kind I had seen in all the others. They weren't blocking me outright. They were just hoping I'd change my mind. Fine, I thought. I could play the same game. I pretended to explore the idea of staying. I asked questions at the diner. I chatted with Vernon when I saw him outside the library. I kept my tone neutral, polite, and even curious. I wanted to believe I was fooling them. But part of me suspected they saw through it. They had watched my father play this role his whole life. They would know the difference between someone preparing to stay and someone buying time to run. Still, I gave myself a deadline. 3 more days. By then, the form should be clear, and I could list the property officially. I would pack my things, drop off the keys, and drive back to a life that, while unremarkable, was blissfully mundane. 2 mornings later, I heard shouting when I reached the town. It echoed from the road, where a group had gathered near the general store. I walked down, heart already sinking, and pushed through the loose crowd of neighbors and passerbys. Vernon was there, standing beside a woman I didn't recognize. She was trembling, holding a child's shoe in both hands. Her face was hollow, blank. Her lips moved, but no sound came out. Vernon rubbed her shoulder, speaking gently, trying to steady her. The sheriff stood nearby, his expression unreadable. He held a radio, but didn't seem to be using it. The townsfolk watched me as I approached. No one said my name. No one called me over. But I could feel the weight of their eyes. I looked down at the woman and realized she was mouthing the same phrase repeatedly. "He was just in the yard." My stomach twisted. I didn't need to ask what had happened. The absence was already there, sharp and undeniable. A child was gone. My first instinct was to turn away, to leave before someone tried to explain it. But I didn't. I stepped closer. Vernon met my gaze, and I saw something worse than judgment in his eyes. I saw relief, thin and brittle, but real. They had expected this. Maybe not this week, maybe not this child, but the moment I arrived and did nothing, they must have known it would come again. Later, when the search party formed and scattered into the woods, I sat with the mother on the store's porch. I brought her a cup of water, but she didn't drink. She never looked at me directly, but I heard her whisper to no one in particular. "They said it wouldn't come back. They said he kept it away." I left her there, the weight of her voice pressing into my chest with each step. Back at the house, I sat in the kitchen, staring at my hands. I could no longer pretend I was just a visitor. I had been the one who could do something, and had chosen not to. I had seen the unraveling child in that thing's arms. I had known what it meant. And still, I waited. I thought I had bought myself time. Instead, I had cost them a child. I found Vernon sitting alone on the church steps that evening, staring out across the empty road. He had a cigarette between his fingers, burned halfway down, and he barely glanced at me when I approached. "That missing kid." My voice was hoarse. I could have stopped it if I had just done something. Vernon took a long drag from the cigarette and exhaled through his nose. "Your father stopped the deaths for decades," he said. "Not because he was chosen, not because he was brave. He stopped them because he knew how to make them strong. He knew how to make them last." I didn't reply. There wasn't anything to say. We both knew what had happened and what needed to happen next. The sun was sinking behind the trees when I returned to the house. The light was thin and golden, cutting through the windows in long slats. Dust drifted in the air, turning slowly in place. I walked through the kitchen, past the old recliner, and out the back door toward the workshop. The key was still in my pocket. The chain still lay coiled beside the threshold, untouched since the day I had opened it. I stepped inside and closed the door behind me. It was cooler in the workshop, the air dense with the smell of cured leather, dried herbs, and the faint chemical bite of old preservatives. The lights flickered to life, humming softly overhead. The unfinished child lay where I'd left it, still covered in a thin sheet of muslin. I pulled the cloth back and studied it in the harsh light. Most of the work had already been done. The form was assembled, the skin stitched into place, the limbs structured with wire and padding. But the joints were too loose, and the seams were still raw at the edges. The eyes were unset, and the face had not been shaped. It was a blank, waiting for identity. I stared at it for a long time. I remembered standing beside my father's workbench when I was a boy, watching him pull thread through squirrel hide, his hands steady, his concentration unbroken. He never treated the process as grotesque. There was a reverence in every movement. Care. He would murmur instructions as he worked, whether to me or to himself, I was never sure. Back then, I thought he was just eccentric. Now I understood it was more than that, It was a ritual. Precision was everything. I found his old toolkit beneath the bench. Bone needles, sinew thread, and steel awl. I rolled up my sleeves and began. The work was slow. My hands were clumsy. I had done some of this before, long ago, but never at this scale, never with this weight behind it. I reinforced the joints first, binding them tight with wire and sealing the sockets with resin. I packed the limbs with additional padding, adjusting the balance of the form so that it could hold still under pressure. The skin had begun to dry at the edges, but was still pliable enough to seal. I traced the seams with wax and pressed them flat. For the eyes, I selected two from a velvet-lined case, deep brown with flecks of amber, and set them gently into the sockets, adjusting the eyelids to meet the gaze. The face was the hardest. I needed to create something that could pass under the gaze of a thing that did not fully understand what it was seeing. It didn't matter about symmetry or expression. It was about suggestion, something that would not be questioned. I shaped the features with careful hands, smoothing the lips, hollowing the cheeks, and curling the mouth's edge into a faint, unreadable smile. By the time I finished, my back ached and my fingers were stiff. I stepped away from the table, wiped my hands on a cloth, and looked down at what I had made. It was no longer unfinished, but it wasn't alive, not in the way things are meant to be alive. It existed in that strange space between presence and absence, between memory and mimicry. I did not know what to do next, so I left it where it lay. That night, I did not sleep easily. I lay in bed, every creak of the old house stirring my nerves. At one point, I heard something shift outside, a series of wooden groans, as though the deck boards were being tested by careful weight. Then the workshop door opened, followed by a soft scuttling in the grass. I heard it clearly, the latch clicking, hinges straining. I held my breath, straining to hear more. But the night had fallen still again. I did not rise. I did not check. I stayed beneath the covers, eyes fixed on the ceiling, heart hammering in my chest. Morning brought no clarity. Just quiet. I stepped outside, the dew still clinging to the grass, and crossed the yard to the workshop. The door was wide open. Inside, the light was off. I pulled the chain and let the glow settle over the room. The child was gone. The muslin stayed folded neatly beside the workbench. The tools were untouched. There were no signs of struggle, no mess, no trace of violence. Only a single trail of footprints, small and spaced evenly, leading out through the open door. I checked the lock. It was unbroken. The mechanism was still functional. Whatever had taken the child had not forced its way in. The door had been opened from the inside. I didn't tell anyone what had happened that night. Not about the sounds, not about the workshop door, not about the empty table or the footprints leading away into the grass. I thought about speaking to Vernon, maybe asking what it meant. But every time I opened my mouth, the words caught somewhere deep in my chest. It turned out, I didn't need to say anything. The town knew. Not all at once, not with celebration or parade, but in quiet acknowledgements that began to collect around me. When I walked into the grocery store, the woman at the counter smiled with real warmth. She asked how I was settling in, then handed me a small basket of preserves and dried herbs without ringing them up. "For the house," she said, "helps with the damp." At the diner, a man I'd never spoken to offered to come by and fix the porch railing. Another brought roofing nails and climbed up without asking, patching the shingles where the leaks had started to form. A basket of eggs appeared on my front step. A cord of firewood was stacked by the fence. My cupboards filled faster than I could empty them. No one said anything about payment. No one hinted at obligation. They simply helped. When I walked through the town, people met my eyes. Some nodded, some smiled, but none of them looked through me anymore. I was no longer a stranger. I was something else. One afternoon, I sat with Vernon outside the hardware store, watching the cars drift past on the road. He handed me a bottle of something cold and home-brewed and leaned back against the bench with a sigh. "Your father never needed to ask for help," he said. "We always made sure he had what he needed. The same goes for you." I nodded, unsure of what to say. That night, two men I barely knew came to my house carrying a canvas sack. Inside were animal parts, not whole specimens, but selections. A deer's leg, a fox's tail, the turtle's broken shell still slick with sweat. One man tipped his hat and said, "More where that came from. You just tell us what to find." I stood there, the sack in my hands, the faint smell of blood and fur rising to meet me. Something shifted in my chest. Not fear. Something closer to acceptance. Back in the city, I'd worked in an office without windows. I had a nameplate on a desk and a phone that never rang. No one invited me out after hours. I ate lunch alone. On birthdays, the same email would go around, a template sent by a secretary who never made eye contact. Here, I woke to fresh bread and stew left on my porch. Here, people knocked on my door to see how I was doing. Here, I mattered. I found myself thinking less about leaving. The workshop had become a place I entered without hesitation. I cleaned the tools, labeled the drawers. I unpacked the sack on the work table, sorting the parts by size and condition. Some would need cleaning, others could be used immediately. The fox's tail was in excellent shape, and the fur was still glossy under the right light. The deer's leg would need reinforcement. I made a note of it in the margins of my father's old supply ledger. I sat alone in the workshop, lit by a single bulb, surrounded by the tools and materials of a life I had never chosen and yet somehow felt drawn to. There was a strange peace in it, the rhythm of preparation, the quiet of acceptance. I was becoming someone here, not because I wanted to be, not because I had been called, but because the town had already decided that I was. My skills were not up to par. There was so much I needed to learn. Luckily, there were a plethora of journals in the workshop, stacked neatly at the back. The journals were written in a looping, meticulous hand. Most were bound in cracked leather or worn cloth, the pages brittle at the corners, filled with diagrams and cross-sections drawn in pencil. My father's handwriting threaded through them, sometimes formal and scientific, other times disjointed, as though written during a moment of sudden realization or emotional strain. Some of the books were older than he was. The ink had faded into sepia, and the pages smelled of mildew and camphor. I found dates scrawled in margins, that reached back nearly a century. There were records, instructions passed down, not from teachers, but from fathers and grandfathers, a private language of stitching, sealing and arranging, notes on what worked and what failed. One entry read, "Too stiff, no warmth, refused it." Another, "Legs proportioned poorly, wandering began within 2 nights." Some were practical, notes on joint placement, stitch integrity, preservatives, and their shelf lives. Others were less so, reflections on the process, theories, speculation on what made the parent respond to one figure and not another. He had written about failure too, of a child that fell apart too quickly, of how the parent had grown confused, then angry, tearing through the woods until it could be coaxed back with something new. The message was clear. It needed consistency, stability, familiarity, something it could return to over and over without doubt. I began to understand the weight of the task and the responsibility of presence. It was not the figure alone that mattered. It was the care behind it, the belief that someone was still watching, still tending, still willing. I read them every night, seated at the workbench with a mug of black coffee and a blanket pulled over my shoulders. I studied the diagrams, copied the methods into a fresh notebook, and sketched what I could from memory. I practiced on scraps of fur and leftover skulls, testing placement, balance, and posture. The details I could handle. The stitching was slow but improving. I had already sealed one mock-up figure and placed it on the side table for observation. It lasted a week before it sagged inward and began to split around the joints. It wasn't enough. Each guide, whether written by my father or one of the ancestors before him, began the same way. Before the diagrams, before the measurements, a heading written in careful script across the top of the page. Source body. That was where it all started. No further explanation, just a silhouette sketched in rough pencil and a list of qualities. Stability, freshness, youth, familiarity. I didn't understand. I'd assumed the base was a form, wood, resin, a mannequin shaped and padded to resemble a child's body. But none of the materials matched the density or movement I had seen in the finished figures. Even the best taxidermy foam couldn't mimic the softness or subtle give I remembered from the one the parent had been holding. I flipped through book after book, looking for clearer guidance. Finally, I found it in a tattered volume tucked into the back of the shelf. The passage was short, written between a supply list and a stitched drawing of a child's hand. It was nearly buried beneath the notes in margins, but the sentence was underlined 3 times, and the pressure of the pen had nearly torn through the page. No taxidermy child will last unless it's rooted in truth. Memory alone is not enough. It must have been real. I read it again, then a third time. It must have been real. The words echoed in my chest with a sickening clarity. The base was not an object. It was not foam, wire, or wood. It was a body. A real one. A child. The reverence made sense now. The strange silence that fell over the town when I arrived. No one ever spoke directly about what my father had done. Only what it had prevented. It explained the grief, the acceptance, and the carefully managed rituals. The cost of one soul to save many. The materials the townspeople brought me, those were supplementary, finishing touches. The actual child had to come from somewhere, someone real, someone once whole. I stood up from the bench, the journal still open in front of me. My hands felt cold. My father had not hunted them, he had not stolen them. From how revered he was, that much was clear. But the cost had always been paid. But how? The careful ink strokes mapping out shoulder alignment, hip angles, eye placement. Then came the knock. It was quiet. Just three short taps against the wood of the workshop door. I hesitated. The hour was late. No one came to the house at this time, not without reason. I stepped to the door and unlocked it, the old handle cool beneath my fingers. Outside stood Vernon. "I've brought the volunteer," he stated casually. Beside him, a boy of maybe 10 or 11. He wore a wool sweater too large for his frame and boots caked in dry mud. His hair was dark and his eyes were steady. What shocked me was that he didn't tremble, didn't cry. There was no way he didn't know what he was here for, yet he showed no signs of hesitation. His hand was in Vernon's, but he let go as I opened the door. I looked down at him, looking for fear, for confusion. The implication of all this was deafening. But there was none. He only stood there, breathing softly, a slight crease between his brows, the kind of look you see in someone waiting to be given a task. He knew what he was here for. He was ready. But was I?
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.